Controversies about the First Amendment dominate the news cycle. There is Facebook, there are college towns that are rocked by historic protests surrounding the issue of campaign speech, American athletes kneel in protest of the national anthem, and tech companies struggle with their potential obligation to censor offensive content, including the president's tweets. Despite the First Amendment's prominence in media headlines, it's clear that most people still don't exactly know what freedom of speech actually means or how the First Amendment works. That according to Stanley Fish. He is a celebrated public intellectual and a New York Times bestselling author. He's the author of the new book, The First. He is the Davidson Kahn Distinguished University Professor of Humanities and Law at Florida International University and a visiting professor of law at Yeshiva University. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Stanley Fish to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What got you thinking about the First Amendment in such a way?
Well, largely because a lot of people believe that First Amendment issues exist when in fact they don't. So they try to latch on to the First Amendment when there really is no either legal or moral reason for doing so. I'll give you a quick example. Recently, an NBA executive, general manager, assistant general manager of the Houston Rockets, tweeted out, "Support freedom, support Hong Kong."
Right.
And he was immediately the center of a situation, and people almost reflexively cried free speech, that this man has the right to say what he said without suffering any consequences. And of course, that's half right. He does have the right to say what he said, but any consequences he suffers are consequences that he must bear, because the NBA is a private enterprise. Its business is entertainment and the growing of the product. And if it's judged that what he said does harm to the product and its potential growth, then the league or the team has every right to rebuke him and to dismiss him and at the very least tell him to keep his mouth shut. There's no free speech issue involved. And that's what interests me, situations where free speech is invoked, but it really isn't to the point.
So the point that you do make in the book is that it is fairly clear that most people don't know exactly what freedom of speech actually means or
right.
How the First Amendment works.
That's correct.
So how do we correct that?
Well, you correct that first by realizing that the First Amendment says that the government cannot either constrain your speech or punish you for speaking your mind. Now, even that requirement has some exceptions to it. But let's say that in general, you hold your free speech rights against the government that might want to abridge them. But you don't have any free speech rights when you're dealing with your boss, your partner, your spouse, your children, someone you meet in the street. And therefore, when you believe that you have the right to speak freely and suddenly find that you are being humiliated or punished or in some other way inconvenienced, you have no constitutional recourse. You're just in an ordinary situation in which you have to resolve the issue in the best way that human beings can resolve issues together.
In that way of resolving issues, given the moment that we're in and given the moment that we're often in, how do you have those conversations when there is such a divide?
Well, that's an excellent question. So let's take the current campus situation as an illustration. Where more and more it is the case that people are being criticized or disciplined or even suspended or fired for having said something. And the university then defends its actions by saying that the university, stands for free speech. Well, the university doesn't stand for free speech. The university stands for the process of education. And free speech rights are sometimes, but only in small quantity, relevant to the process of education. The way I usually put this is to say that colleges and universities are not in the free speech business, so that they should not, in fact, either be policing their students and faculty members, nor standing up for their free speech. Free speech, at least in my view, has nothing to do with what goes on in university campuses.
You have a chapter in the book called Why Freedom of Speech is Not an Academic Value.
Yes.
Freedom of speech versus freedom of inquiry. Universities are not in the democracy business. What business are they? I mean, we know what business they're in, but what is their role in this?
Well, what do you hope goes on in the classroom and also in the research that professors do? You hope that they are advancing knowledge in a particular field. And in order to advance knowledge in a particular field, you have to hear or listen to many voices which offer competing proposals, but not any old voices. That is, it's not as it is in, let's say, the ideal democracy that all persons have a right to their say. In the university, the only people who have a right to their say are those who have been voted in by departments or approved by promotion committees or published by university presses or learned journals. So that the university, as opposed to a democracy, is a place in which more people are sent away and told you cannot speak than people are told you can speak. Freedom of inquiry involves keeping the channels open, but the channels are only open for those persons who have been vetted and approved in advance by the university authorities, and that's the difference.
You tell two stories in the book, and I'm curious of just giving us a sense of these stories, beginning with the Amy Wax story.
Yes, Amy Wax is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania who has what we might call controversial views. She has views, for example, on immigration, and is one of those who believe that it's best to accept immigrants from countries whose values and culture are like our own. She also believes that it is best for persons of color who have not succeeded in the usual testing system to attend colleges that are more likely to recognize their worth than to attend high-level colleges where they will feel uncomfortable because they will feel unprepared. Now, these are, of course, controversial views, and she has uttered them in various contexts, and her dean has punished her for doing so, has in fact removed her from the teaching of a first-year course, civil procedure, that she has taught for many years. And it seems to me, at least, that the dean is entirely mistaken, that he is surrendered to political pressures and is not enforcing the academic enterprise, which I think, correctly understood, would prevent him from censuring and limiting her activities.
James Tracy was fired from Florida Atlantic University. He made several comments in blogs and other public venues about the Sandy Hook tragedy in Newtown.
Yes.
He basically said that it was staged with the intention of creating a favorable climate for the passage of gun control legislation. He was fired. And as you mentioned, the same claim, we're getting rid of you, but we're not punishing you for your ideas, was made. Were they right in firing him?
No, they were not, unless they could prove that he was using his classroom as a theater or a platform to spread his political views. There was absolutely no evidence of that, and the evidence that we do have from teaching evaluation suggests that he was an eminently fair teacher who provoked discussion and accepted a wide range of opinions. It seems to me clear that the university simply found what he had said as a public citizen an embarrassment and therefore decided to get rid of him and made up reasons for doing so.
But one of those reasons was not about at least they said, it was not about the ideas that he was espousing. But as you note, I mean, part of this story with James Tracy is that he engaged in a dialogue with the parents of a child who died in that massacre.
He did.
And so if you are the university, do you look at that and say, all right, this is not acceptable behavior for a professor who is representing this college?
The professor is representing the college when he or she runs a classroom that is educationally sound. That is, the course material is as advertised. The teacher has acquainted himself or herself with the up-to-date research in the field and is presenting it to the students. That's what it means to represent the university responsibly. What you say in an outside publication or a letter to the editor should have no bearing at all on your status as a university employee. Like any other citizen, you have the right to express yourself. And it can't be the case that university professors must be wary of expressing themselves in outside venues, lest some college administrator become unhappy with what they've said. So this is a category mistake that university administrations often have. They can't make the distinction between a professor who is also a citizen and therefore has the right to his opinions outside the classroom and his performance in the classroom. It's his or her performance in the classroom that is the proper object of scrutiny for the university.
Stanley Fish is the author of the new book, The First. Okay, let's get into it some more. Religion. So you say that the religion clause of the First Amendment does not belong in our United States Constitution.
Yes, I do.
Why do you believe that?
Because I think the United States Constitution breeds what we might call a liberal spirit. And by liberal, I don't mean liberal in the Democratic versus Republican sense, but in the sense of classical liberalism, where it's the business of society to figure out what to do and the people who are doing the figuring out are free and autonomous individual citizens like you and me. And what that means is that no point of view should either be made holy in advance or should be dismissed as unworthy of being heard in advance. But the religion clause of the Constitution does both things with religion. In the free exercise clause, the religion clause tells us that we must allow religious persons a scope of action larger than the scope of action that would be allowed to non-religious persons. So that's preferring religion in a positive way. And the Establishment Clause warns us against allowing religious views to make their way into the public sphere and forum. So that's a negative view toward religion. But according to the liberal principles of the Constitution, neither of those things should happen. That is, there shouldn't be a special form of discourse that is regarded either with particular approval or particular disapproval. But in fact, that's what we have.
You talk in that chapter about free exercise cases, including the well-known cases about the photographer who refused to take photos of a ceremony for a same-sex couple.
Right.
And then also, of course, the baker case of not baking a cake for a gay couple getting married. So how do you look at the lower courts and then how the courts have decided on that and what ultimately we are left with in the wake of those decisions?
I think we're left with an irresolvable conflict, which is a function of the conflict that I spoke of a few moments ago. On the one hand, you do have the free exercise clause, which suggests that religious persons should be allowed to perform acts which are inspired by their faiths. And that's what the baker and the florist and the photographer are saying. Our faith commands that we not participate in this sinful activity. And on the other hand, you have general anti-discrimination laws established by a state that has as one of its goals the elimination of discrimination. And those laws say if you hang up your shingle, you must serve all comers. My point in that chapter is that these two points of view are irreconcilable and that the courts are going to swing back and forth between supporting one and supporting the other. Right now, the situation is that the lower courts are supporting the claims of the state and its anti-discrimination mechanisms, whereas the Supreme Court, in the most recent decision, has supported the baker and his right to decline service to same-sex couples. This is not the end of it. The pendulum will continue to swing.
Let me end with this. You talk about transparency in the book, and the chapter is titled "Why Transparency is the Mother of Fake News." You make a case against transparency.
Yes. I make a case against transparency, and it's really simple. What transparency means to those who argue for it is the removal of traditional filters and gatekeepers, and allowing the data and the facts to speak for themselves and to be communicated immediately to us as viewers. In effect, what this means is that the proliferation of data and fact, which accompanies an internet world, leaves us with all of these facts like little bits of Lego lying around and just inviting some person with bad intentions to put them together into a story that will serve political nefarious ends. And the reason that this is allowed to happen is because of the rage for transparency and the distrust of traditional repositories of authority, like major newspapers, major networks, university experts, and so on, all of whom filtered all the data so that what reached us had already, we might say, been curated or vetted in advance. The apostles of transparency don't want that. They want a brave new world where all data is free and open. And what I am saying is that's not a brave new world. That's just a version of hell.
If we have the First Amendment operating the way that you believe it was intended, how does our life change?
Well, I don't even know what it is that was intended, because the First Amendment, as you know, is very general. And in fact, my argument in the book is that the First Amendment is not a single thing, but a set of practices that differs from context to context. So the First Amendment will have a somewhat different shape and context in university situations, in church-state situations, in commercial and business situations. So the only thing that you can do is learn the ropes, that is, learn the ways the First Amendment has been invoked and utilized in a particular practice, and then act accordingly. If you're looking for a core, principled, single value of the First Amendment, you're never going to find it.
The name of the book is The First. It is published by Atria One Signal Publishers. Stanley Fish, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The First, How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. The book is published by Atria, One Signal Publishers. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.